At least two people are reported dead after a missile attack in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro.
The debris of the missile hit the gas station, and unfortunately, there are victims as a result of this hit.
Plus, as Russia continues its global disinformation campaign, why is it targeting the African continent?
We might actually see a social unrest in Africa that may lead to additional refugee crisis that Russia will weaponize, and that may actually destabilize Europe.
And later in the program, how three high school students are using technology to help young refugees find safety. Today is Wednesday, October 26th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Israeli President Isaac Herzog plans to share intelligence about Iranian drones being used by Russian forces in Ukraine when he meets on Wednesday with U.S. President Joe Biden. Herzog's office says that Israel has images showing similarities between drones shot down in Ukraine and those that Iran tested in 2021. Ukraine and its Western partners have said that Russia's recent use of drones to attack Ukrainian cities, including Kyiv, involves Iranian-made Shahed 136 drones. Iran has denied supplying them to Russia, and Russia has denied using them in Ukraine, and also plans on discussing the accusations at a United Nations Security Council meeting on Wednesday. In Ukraine, at least two people have been killed at a gas station fire after a missile attack in Dnipro. Joining us from Kyiv with more is Anna Chernikova.
Yeah, it was yesterday in the evening that this heat happened. In general, it was an air raid siren over the region for around 1 hour from 9 o'clock in the evening until 10 o'clock in the evening. What we know for the moment that the debris of the missile hit the gas station. And unfortunately, there are victims as a result of this hit. We know that one pregnant young woman was killed. She was, at that moment, she was inside of the car at this petrol station. And also the worker of the petrol station was killed. We know about three people injured, including the husband of the victim of the pregnant woman. Three people are currently in the hospital with different kind of injuries. In general, the city of Dnipro is constantly under attacks, but the last one that we heard that it was a hit actually was a couple of weeks ago, the same day when the city of Kyiv was also hit by Russian missiles.
And Anna, if we turn our attention to the Kherson region, I understand the Ukrainian military has reported that they've carried out operations against enemy forces.
General staff continue to confirm some, you know, a little details step by step. What we hear now that actually yesterday Ukrainian forces managed to conduct an attack targeting a base of the Kadyrov militants who were located in one of the settlements in Kherson region. According to the information that we get, again, we cannot confirm it independently and verify it for the moment, but there is information about at least 30 Kadyrov militants dead, and another 100 apparently are under the rubble of the base that was hit. This was confirmed by the Ukrainian general staff. And also we are hearing that around Kherson region, there is basically quite constant attacks conducted by the Ukrainian forces, not only on the logistics and logistic facilities, but also on the bases of Russian forces. And this time it was confirmed that it was Kadyrov militants' base.
Reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine, Anna Chernikova. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
A group of liberal U.S. Democrats withdrew a letter to the White House on Tuesday, urging a negotiated settlement to the war in Ukraine, according to the chairperson, Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal, after a blowback within their own party. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson has the details.
Only a day later, they withdrew the letter, with Pramila Jayapal, the chairperson of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, saying in a statement, quote, The letter was drafted several months ago, but unfortunately was released by staff without vetting. The letter, signed by 30 caucus members, was made public on Monday. It left some Democrats feeling blindsided just 2 weeks before the midterm elections. Some, like Representative Sarah Jacobs, said they had signed the letter months earlier and that things had changed. She tweeted, "Timing in diplomacy is everything. I wouldn't sign it today." Ukraine's troops have been waging a successful counteroffensive, with forces advancing into Russian-occupied Kherson province and threatening a major defeat for Moscow. Russia invaded Ukraine in February in what it called a special military operation designed to disarm its neighbor.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. As Russia escalates its attacks in Ukraine, Estonia looks with concern to the east, to its Russian neighbor, but also within, to itself. With a significant Russian-speaking population, the influence of Russian propaganda through the media is, for the many, a cause for concern. Marcus Harton narrates that story.
The Narva River separates Estonia and Russia, one of the points of contact between NATO and Russia. The city of Narva, like much of the east of the country, is mostly Russian-speaking, and its population maintains close cultural and economic ties with Russia. Narva's people strive to preserve Russian traditions and culture, but they are very annoyed at any suggestion that they are agents of the Kremlin inside Estonia, a criticism sometimes made by Estonian nationalists.
We are not agents of anyone. How could we be? That is an idea that someone promoted from power. But in my opinion, the Estonian people are generally very inclusive.
Estonian authorities have for years warned of Russian expansionism and have considered the Kremlin the greatest threat to the country's sovereignty long before the start of the invasion of Ukraine, analysts tell us.
So far in Estonia, there never has been civil war. From the military point of view, of course, there is only Russia. There are no military threats from Finland, Sweden or Latvia. Very simple, and it has been so simple already since regaining independence in 1991.
Estonians regard their years as a Soviet republic as years of occupation. The weight of history is even greater now that Estonians see Russia stepping up its attacks on Ukraine.
So I think what has happened now with the last months and especially with the war going on in Ukraine is that we have started to value the independence and the freedom from a new perspective.
But after the Soviet collapse and the return of an independent Estonia, the process of integration of the Russian-speaking minority does not seem to have happened.
This is definitely something that is not a success story in Estonia, the integration. How Russian-speaking communities have been integrated to Estonian society within the last 30 years. And there are very big challenges in there.
Like in other countries that were under Russian communist rule, language plays an important role in identity and sovereignty. And while Russia is still spoken in much of Estonia, its use is decreasing as more people focus on the Estonian language.
I think that if I look back, let's say 30 years, when Russification was in full swing at the schools, then compared to that, Estonian is really being cared for and loved very much here now.
And while the children of this village carry on with their Estonian classes, a group of Russian-speaking Ukrainian refugee children from Donetsk, Odessa, and Nikolaev rehearse Estonian regional dances, a process of integration into Estonian culture that, curiously, is done in the Russian language. For Ricardo Marquina in Tallinn, Estonia, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. On yesterday's program, I spoke with the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Ivana Stradner and discussed the state of Russian media throughout these 8 months of war. At the tail end of our conversation, Ivana mentioned the strategic importance that the African continent plays in Moscow's overall disinformation campaign. And that's where we pick things up today. Ivana, this is an interesting topic, the notion that Africa is a focus for Moscow. Because when we take a look at the votes in the United Nations when it pertains to Russia on the world stage, and specifically with Ukraine, in the past we have seen a large number of African countries abstain. And some have theorized that maybe because of the ties between these countries and Russia, because they do purchase military equipment from Moscow, and there are some financial dealings between these two countries, that they are trying to struggle with how to effectively balance their ties with Moscow and the global condemnation of Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine.
Precisely that. And not only that, the reason I think why also Russia is paying specifically right now attention to Africa, because of the food crisis, we can actually see, we might actually see a social unrest in Africa that may lead to additional refugee crisis that Russia will weaponize, and that may actually destabilize Europe. So it's not that Russia is waging this war only with drones and missiles. And with tanks, Russia is waging also war using cognitive weapons to destabilize Europe by weaponizing and then fill it in blank, whether it's information, whether it's refugee crisis, whether it's food crisis, whether it's energy crisis. And it works. I mean, even now with nuclear weapons, Putin knows very well that people do remember the Cold War. And posting all those photos from World War II and what they portrayed as the end of the world, he really knows how to appeal to people's emotions and how to make them scared so the West actually backs down and stops supporting Ukraine.
Thank you very much for taking the time to explain that. Another question I have really pertains to Russian state television, because over the past few weeks, maybe month or longer, we have seen greater critical voices appear on television. In fact, just making the rounds on Twitter this last week, and I haven't been able to independently verify yet the transcription, but there appeared to be a video showing a military commenter on one of these TV pundit shows in Russia who was very critical of Russia's operation in Ukraine. And I wanted to ask you about this, not specifically that video, but Russian state media and state television is carefully choreographed. So what do you make out of these recent appearances of critical voices?
Absolutely. It is very controlled. And I've noticed the same thing. I do not pay that much attention to what they are saying on their national TV. I pay more attention to what certain bloggers, certain voices, and also regular people are saying on Russian social media. And given, you know, as I mentioned, that the rise of nationalism is rising, people are very disappointed in how Putin actually has destroyed the Russian greatness, that he betrayed Russia for waging what they call it unsuccessful war. It's not that they are against war, they are just against the fact how Putin is not succeeding. So that's something that I've noticed. The more and more the far right groups are actually delivering messages against Putin.
What about some of the other messaging that Moscow is putting out? Because in recent times, they have characterized the situation around Ukraine as very much a battle between Russia and the West.
Russia has been also trying to appeal to different groups in the West, whether they're on the far right or the far left. And now, given that there is so much criticism against Russia, they had to respond to this. So they they are now intensively weaponizing Russophobia to appeal to the far left groups, claiming that the West is racist and that we should not criticize Russia. This is nothing new, given that Russia has been weaponizing the same narrative for decades. But that's something that we should definitely pay attention to it more, because I see more and more voices on social media in the West criticizing people who are criticizing Russia. And it's not only about Russophobia, they also link it to American imperialism and British colonialism. These are just the narratives that Russia has been using over the past few weeks intensively, even though Russia was doing that even in the past.
Ivana Stradner is with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Ivana, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Two former Ukrainian prisoners of war told Reuters News on October 25th that they faced overcrowding and hunger to the point of fainting when they were detained by Russian forces. Reuters' Angela Johnston brings us their story.
For these Ukrainian former prisoners of war, their time spent in Russian captivity is never far from mind. Alina Panina, who worked at Mariupol's port before the war, is among more than 200 detainees who were freed on October 17th in one of the war's biggest prisoner swaps.
Some of us used to faint because we didn't have enough to eat. We were led outside once a day for 15 minutes. That's why some fainted. The sugar level, glucose, fell because there was not enough food.
The 25-year-old helped defend a factory in Mariupol during a months-long siege before Russian forces took the city in mid-May. Panina says the one saving grace was that women were allowed by their captors to bake bread. She says more than two dozen women were forced to share a room intended only for six, and that they had also been forced to drink non-potable water. Those conditions were echoed by her former commander, Valery Patitil, who was freed in a swap in September. "They didn't treat us like humans," the Donetsk region border guard colonel said, adding that he too faced hunger and maltreatment.
"They thought that after 1 month, we'd ask to join them. Not a single one of us did that. Nobody lost their spirit. Nobody lost faith."
Russia denies maltreatment of POWs. It says its actions in Ukraine are a special military operation to protect Russian security interests.
Angela Johnston of Reuters News. Lydia and Gabriela Oros are the founders of the Ukrainian Habitat Fund. And that organization helps Ukrainian refugees find and pay for housing in New York City. They're using their backgrounds in real estate to arrange discounted housing for refugee families and to help them pay rent. They tell VOA's Marissa Melton, so far they've placed seven families and have a waiting list of more than 40.
The first thing I wanted to ask, if you can just briefly describe the work of the Ukrainian Habitat Fund, how would you encapsulate that?
Sure. So my name is Gabriela Oros. The Ukrainian Habitat Fund was founded in 2022 as a direct result of the war that began in February in Ukraine. The fund's mission is to provide affordable housing and additional support services for Ukrainian families coming to New York City and to provide additional financial support as needed.
Can you tell me about the typical path for your clients, kind of what situation they go from in Ukraine and what it takes to end up in New York City and able to avail themselves of your help?
So many families fleeing Ukraine immediately, you know, went to neighboring countries such as Poland and Hungary. But while these countries have provided amazing support over the last few months, the scale of the refugees' migration is often, you know, straining the resources of these countries. So naturally, many continue their journey to countries such as U.S. We connected to the families arriving in the U.S. and needing housing across a number of channels. Our wide networks, friends, and partners often surfaces of families who need our support. They also reach out to us directly by finding us randomly online.
Are most of the families you're helping the women and the children, do the fathers have to stay behind in Ukraine to fight?
This is Lydia and I'm speaking. Many of the refugees reaching out to our fund are women with children, where their men still fighting in the war. And you can actually see on our website, one of the earliest families that we have housed is Lesya, who arrived here with two children, and her husband is actively fighting in the war. And she's been in communications with him on a daily basis and keeps us updated how it is on the ground there.
Is it hard working with landlords in New York City? Do you have contacts through your work that make that easier?
To Lydia, continue. So we are coming from a real estate background, and a couple of our board members are also coming from real estate background. We are reaching to our resources and asking anyone. It can be a landlord with just one building or one unit, or it can be a big corporation. Whoever can help us with housing, we would greatly appreciate it. Our goal is to negotiate the rents down, which has been a bit of a challenge in the summertime because the real estate market was at the peak. But we still pushed through it, and we were able to house families despite the rise in prices.
I want to ask where people can go for more information about your work. And for people who are listening and would like to help maybe the huge numbers of people who can't leave Ukraine, do you have any suggestions?
Anyone who wants to help, they can always go to our website, ukrainianhabitat.org, and fill out a form. We'll get back to them, and we can redirect them or partner up with them. Whichever way we can help Ukraine and Ukrainian people, we are here.
Those are the founders of the Ukrainian Habitat Fund, Lydia and Gabriela Oros. They were speaking to VOA's Marissa Melton. Helping people find a safe way to a safe place, well, that's the goal of a new app called Refi, created by three Ukrainian high schoolers. Anna Rice narrates that story to round us out.
Over 2 million children, according to the UN, have become refugees as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Some of them, like 11-year-old Hassan Al-Khalaf, crossed the Ukrainian border into Slovakia alone.
The thought that my mom would have liked this gave me strength.
Around the same time, three high school girls learned of Hassan's story while they were preparing to participate in the international IT contest for young women called Technovation. His story inspired them to create an app for refugees under the age of 14.
Welcome to Refi. It's an app created to help the children who were forced to cross the border without their parents.
Our app offers a translation service, geolocation, and a call to a specialized hotline.
And the app offers some preset sentences that allow young children to communicate big ideas.
If we're talking about a young six-year-old kid, he or she might not know how to enter a sentence correctly. So we wanted to create a translation service that would be simple to use. The kid can just press a button and a translation appears.
So far, the app offers several languages.
It's Polish, Slovakian, German, Hungarian, and English. The idea is fairly global, so the number of languages will grow in the future.
Refi can help a child find their location and get in touch with volunteers or police.
If a child is lost or has problems, he or she can push a button and the app will connect them to a hotline where they can get help.
The Refi app creators won the National Ride of Technovation contest and got to the semi-finals on the international level. But their idea had such a big impact that even after the contest, Technovation is doing what it can to support the three young women.
I helped them get funding from our network. Three of them are refugees with very little financial support. I mean, they need money to be able to survive, support their families, and build this solution and take it to market.
The pilot version of the app will be released late this fall. Then the young women will hold a series of interviews with refugees to see how they can improve the app and hopefully bring it to the U.S. market. For Lesya Bakalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.